The American mystic Joel Goldsmith. Said something which struck me very deeply. He said we have to free people in our lives from considering them as individuals. We have to see God sitting in the midst of them. We have to give freedom to people. And how do we give that freedom? By not seeing them as individuals doing something to me. But as individuals who are shaped by a force, given a set of genetics, conditioning, since their birth, which has made them who they are. When this realization happens that nobody can help being who they are and how God made them, we have freed them. And when we free them, we have freed ourselves. You cannot get freedom from people without giving it to them first. As you sow, so you reap. Once I understand this, I now have to decide what to do. If I have an individual troubling me, this does not mean because God is in the midst of them that I take any nonsense coming my way. But I find my whole dimension of response has changed. I am more objective now, non-reactive perhaps, weigh the pros and cons, and then say what I have to say or do what I have to do. But my guns are no longer targeted at an individual doing something to me. That is the only difference. And so this is how I live my life by and by. Seeing the hand of God behind it all. When this is seen, then we can understand what Goldsmith meant when he said that the karmic law is nullified because the dream of duality is punctured. We have woken up from this dream. And when we wake up from this living dream of life, we find we are not lost in its grip anymore, like we used to be. We are not sucked into the illusion of separation like we used to be. Always action and reaction, action and reaction, non-stop. In other words, we could say, we are no longer sowing more seeds of karma based on doership, which we were unconsciously doing earlier. According to me, this is one of the greatest gifts which Krishna has given in the Bhagavad Gita. The ego deluded thinks I am the doer. Which also means the ego deluded thinks others are the doers. Yet, I have a role to play. God has given me a certain set of attributes. Do what I do, I must. So I am playing out my dharma, knowing what is meant to happen will happen. Not what I want to happen will happen. In any situation I am faced, whether an event in my life, whether a particular person in my life, I do what I think and feel I should do. But now I know I cannot guarantee the result. I never could. So I am at peace. So it is but natural that life becomes peaceful. Because I've stopped making demands on people and on situations that they should be a certain way. The whole process of making demands on life is finished. I may prefer things be a certain way and I act accordingly, but I've freed myself from this burden of trying to change people, forcing them to see my point of view, or complaining to God all the time. That dialogue is burnt to ash. Then I am truly free. It's so beautiful. Just take one thing in your life which you know you have complained about a lot. That one thing. And ask yourself, who is the complainer? The one who wanted things to be another way. That is what is troubling me. Not the situation. It is the complainer complaining which is troubling me. We don't look at that. We think there's an outside source and we raise complaints. But that complainer complaining is in my own head. It's a revelation. That is when the ego is exposed. The spiritual journey is a journey of exposing myself. If your memory was wiped out, would you complain? If I pressed a button now and wiped out your memory, that is why babies and young children don't complain, because the burden of memory is not built up yet. The human being has built this mountain of memories of this happened to me. Not this happened. This happened to me. That is the true burden of the memory. Not the memory itself. And when I free people from this obligation to me, I start becoming more joyful. Children are joyful. We lose that sense of joy as we grow up. This is a rediscovery of that. We enjoy people for being who they are. We start looking for the good in people we never thought there was good in. We stop looking for the bad. Usually the ego loves to put down, find a fault in someone, and most likely not tell it on their face, but tell it behind their backs. Criticizing and condemning others, but I don't have the guts to tell it to you on your face. But when I'm having a cup of coffee with my friends, I will criticize you. That is what the ego does. Who is criticizing whom? One creation of God is criticizing another creation of God. Isn't it absurd? These are absurd collective habits. And we conform to them because we want to be accepted by society, by our friends. These are the games we start giving up. And then we are only looking for where's my peace to be found. Today, where's my peace to be found? In this situation, where's my peace to be found? The focus has shifted to the peace which the Buddha talks about, the peace which Jesus talks about. Not the peace which is the opposite of war, because then again I am polarized in duality, because peace will turn into war, war will turn into peace. The peace which, when Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world, it is not of this polaric opposite of war. My peace is a peace which does not depend on the pairs of opposites. It is a true peace, a deep peace. It is not a peace where when everything is all right, I am peaceful. Everything is not going to be all right, most of the time. But when I've seen this, everything is not going to be all right most of the time, and my own personal experience, then I start becoming okay with whatever is happening. This is the freedom. It is not some big word out there in the future, liberation, moksha, this, that, and all, which I have to strive for. It is available today. I had met one person in a very big publishing house many years ago. And he was with that house itself for many years. He was in the editing department. So he said how they would put so much effort behind books. And the books they thought would become bestsellers never did. And the books they thought would never become bestsellers did. And he said, over time, our experience showed us that out of every 100 titles we published, 3 would be bestsellers, which is a success rate of 3%, right? Which 3 is guesswork? So he said, I used to be so upset earlier that some titles I put in so much effort, nothing happened. Others I didn't really put and they became bestsellers. It was very demotivating at first. He said, but then I realized this is the law of averages in publishing. This is how it is. So my whole perspective changed to as long as we get three bestsellers out of 100, I'm fine. See how it works. You are at peace with the situation. Otherwise, you could complain in your career all the time. Why only three? Why not 10? Why only those three where I've not put effort? What about where I've put effort? This complainer is the one who disappears. Then you say it is what it is. Yet, I have to try my best. Knowing which title becomes a bestseller is not in my hands. So it doesn't mean he gives up hope, he doesn't give up his job, but the realization is there. This is the nature of things. The understanding is there. And he goes on in a peaceful way. And he's still with that publishing house. Would anyone like to share anything or ask any question? You're welcome to. Can you get the mic there?
The trying our best.
Trying our best.
Yeah, there's no real definition of what best is, right? There's no real definition of what best is. So, trying our best in can also be, it can lead us into doership. Or being identified with trying our best.
Supposing I am studying for an exam, whether it is biology, chemistry, mathematics, the teacher has taught me in class. I have tried to absorb what is being taught to the best of my ability. Yet, whether I get 40 on 100, 80 on 100, is not in my control. So the person who has got 40 on 100 may have tried his best, but his best got him only 40 on 100. But someone else's best may have got 80 on 100. You see? So all we can do in a situation is try. This is what trying our best is, based on our nature. If I am an investment manager and I'm playing the stock market, I am going to try my best to make myself money. I am going to use my intellect, my experience, my background, and try my best. But whether I make the money or not is not in my hands. I may think a particular stock is the best bet and it crashes the next day. Now, where does the doership come in? If I am trying to force an outcome, for example, I am an investment manager, no matter what decisions I take, I'm always losing money. Then that is called experience. And if I keep pushing and pushing in order to make money, and that's repeatedly not happening, that is too much doership. Then I realize, hey, this is not for me. I remember one graffiti. If at first you don't succeed, then skydiving isn't for you. So these are different things what you have raised. Now imagine I have the aptitude for mathematics. I know I can get 90 on 100. But I say, oh, I'm lazy, I'm not going to attempt it. That would be doership. Ego coming in through the back door. When it is my nature, when it is my ability, when I'm gifted to understand mathematics and a 90 on 100 is quite possible, I flow with it. I had a very close friend, or rather I have. I used to be envious of him in school because I would have to mug up geography chapters. Line by line, line by line. He was not even opening the book till about a week before the exams. And I was like, isn't this guy scared or nervous? And then 4 days before the exams, he'll call me in the morning. I finished 3 chapters. And he would get more marks than me. And I felt this is unfair. But he obviously was gifted with supersonic memory. He just had to read the chapter once and he could provide answers on it. Our suffering is when we compare and judge. He got 86 on 100, I should have got, or I should have got more. That is where the suffering comes. But it happened to me once in college. It was a French exam. It was a very bizarre experience that the teacher told everyone, do what you all want. I'm leaving. I have to go out. It was exam time. And behind me was this girl who had really aced the French language. So when the teacher left and the door closed, we couldn't figure out is the teacher testing us or what, but everyone started asking everyone else for answers. So I asked her, I said, can you tell me this, this? Everyone shared notes and all. And when the results came, I got higher marks than her. I'll never forget that in French. She was so upset. Crazy. What is in our nature to do is not doership. Someone would tell my teacher that if I listen to your teaching, then that means I should sit in bed all day and not do anything. Whatever is meant to happen will happen. So my teacher would say, but when it's time to go to the toilet, you will get up and go. Because it is your nature to get up and go. If I am in a profession of consulting, helping someone out, I will try my best. Where's the doership in that? It is a natural functioning based on my education experience, my working mind fully functioning in the hope of making a difference. That is all.
Sorry.
That's for the recording.
So if I have understood the doership correctly, can we sum up it's there where it's my desire invested?
What would you mean by that?
Like having a personal desire, and of course we do have preferences, right? I want to do something because I want a preferable outcome. But, you know, sometimes there is too stickiness in that preference, it's too desire, it's too like where my happiness is invested, if you can say. So if I'm investing my happiness in pursuing that, that creates a doer. It's not with a natural flow. It's just...
You could say that. Pursuing a desire to the detriment of others and myself is too much doership. Pursuing a desire where I say things I didn't mean to, I hurt people, I hurt myself. We could say that is all destined, but that is too much doership. And the common example is what my teacher would always say, which I've mentioned so often, that a man at the end of the day, hard working day, goes home, wants a beer, and tells his wife, could you get me the beer from the fridge? And she goes and sees there's no beer. So what has happened? Desire for beer has arisen. But the minute she says there's no beer, he gets upset. You know I like my beer. You're not doing your job properly. You're not controlling the house properly. What kind of nonsense is this? So he's frustrated, because the desire is being pursued. And then he tells the wife, or he goes himself down to the wine shop, and the wine shop says the beer is out of stock. So he gets even more angry, even more frustrated. So this pursuing the desire, a desire is a natural arising. The thought, oh, I had a hard working day, let me enjoy a beer or coffee or whatever it may be. But because when it is not fulfilled, I pursue it and I blame and hate others and myself, that is based on doership. They did something. In this case, she did not stock up the fridge properly. You see how doership seeps into the equation. Desire is desire. Now I have the desire for piping hot coffee. So I make it very clear when I'm placing the order that I would like it extra hot. Now in London, they write extra hot on the cup and the lady will say that, sir, if it's not extra hot, you let us know and we'll make you another cup. Here, yes, yes, we understood, and it doesn't come extra hot. Now what can I do? I can request it to be reheated. Some cafes reheat it, others don't. That's what it is. Who am I going to blame? So you see, the doership steps in later.
Yeah. This is what we say, the mind always steps in later to take the credit. But in the spontaneity, in the flow, it's just...
Yeah.
What is duality or non-duality in action or in practical day-to-day life?
This daily life is the framework of duality. We have been born into it. Which means everything has its opposite. Success opposite is failure. Front opposite is back. Health opposite is illness. Pleasure opposite is pain. And we have all experienced these polaric opposites. So we cannot come out of this. This life as it is designed by the source is a life of duality of every conceivable kind. The sage understands this. The ordinary person is shunted between the polaric opposites throughout their lives and therefore suffers till the last breath. The sage has seen that life does not mean pleasure all the time. There's pleasure and pain. So he has stepped away from the polaric opposites. In that sense, you could say he is leading a non-dual life, though it is not really non-dual. It all means he is no longer trapped in the duality. Yes. That is all. Because, you know, these are very big words, duality, non-duality, and people really talk about them as if there is a full experience and understanding of them. Yes. Yes, absolutely. Really? You cannot come out of this duality. That is why people didn't understand Jesus when he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." They thought his kingdom is up there somewhere. It is here only. Heaven and hell are here.
Exactly.
Beyond.
Exactly. Like other day we were just telling that Kabir's famous doha, na? Dukh mein simran sab kare, sukh mein kare na koi. Jo sukh mein simran kare, to dukh kaave ko hoi. As you rightly said, not the peace which is opposite to the war, but the peace which never comes and goes between, like, you know, just step behind. So it's taken, whatever happens, it happens. Like what the Jiddu Krishnamurti says, whatever happened, I don't mind.
You see, it's not going beyond. It is going, becoming prior to it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Just explain a little bit. So happy to be there.
For any pleasure to arise, you have to be there first, right? Supposing, what is your favorite dessert? What is your favorite dessert?
Ice cream.
Ice cream. Which flavor?
Chocolate.
Chocolate. So the chocolate ice cream is brought in front of you and you say, wow. So what was there first? The chocolate ice cream or you?
Pain.
Correct. Same with the pain. A headache happens. Who was there first, you or the headache? So what was prior to the headache? Prior to the ice cream? So the sage is in that zone where whether it is ice cream or headache, the awareness is that he is prior to it, not beyond it. Everything is arising within his consciousness. So in that sense, he is always ever there. We have got lost in the ice cream and lost in the headache.
So whether it's pleasure or pain, I am prior to that.
That is your own experience. You are alive, you are conscious, so that is your own experience. The sage rests in that.
Yeah. So for the sage, it's non-dual, like.
You could say in that. The sense that it does not have the grip on the sage like it has on us.
Exactly.
Yet he suffers the headache. And he enjoys the ice cream. He enjoys the ice cream because He doesn't know when the next chocolate ice cream will come. We are already thinking that I enjoyed it so much, should I buy another one and keep it in the fridge? What if this brand closes? It happened to me. When I was 16 or 17, there was a brand launched by Cadbury's called Dollops Ice Cream. Dollops Ice Cream made a particular ice cream called Black Currant. And I was in love with the color. It was a violet purple color. Every week I would go down and buy that slab of Dollops. And then someone told me this company is closing down. I went and bought three. That is what we do. The sage does not. The sage enjoys it in the moment. That is why my teacher would call the sage a Mahabhogi, a super enjoyer. We, while we are enjoying it, are calculating things. You know, especially if you are given a chocolate ice cream and you have to share it with the table, you start calculating.
Yes.
That bloody hell, what if they take most of it? I have seen that also happen at dinner tables. You order one dish and then the waiter's taking it around and you're just, people are sitting saying, how much will be left for me?
That's true.
You can pass it on. It's amazing, you know, that because you really, this grip which the dualistic world had on you starts loosening up. And therein you find your peace. That is what happens.
Yeah, hello Gautam. Pleasure to be here. I'm Prashant. I've come before. So, first, I have a statement to narrate. Probably you can highlight it if my understanding of the statement is correct. So I tend to understand the non-duality is a push which takes you away from the duality and takes you away from doership and the other thing which keeps aspiring, which is not your true nature. So this push is what non-duality appears to me, the concept of non-duality. You are which you are not, which you are aware of, but you are the awareness itself. So I just want your view on that. That's one. Second very intriguing thing for me has been the origin of the thoughts.
Can we complete the first one? You are quite right. But it is not a push, it is a pull. The doership was the push. This is a pull back to the source. It is a going within. It is, because we were lost in the dualistic world, a refocus of coming back to the center. That is what has happened. Push is doership.
Yeah.
Right? Pull is when this constant push since childhood, all the time achieving, wanting, doing, is re-looked at and understood. So it's like, you could not even a pull, I would say a withdrawing. A withdrawing. And seeing things as they are, not as I thought they were. Okay, second?
Second, which intrigues me, is the origin of thoughts. The thoughts arise, probably Ramesh would say they arise randomly or from your genes or from your conditioning, from your past memory, you know. It's very intriguing. I try to go to the origin of thoughts and I just get lost somewhere, you know. And I keep identifying myself with the thoughts, either in past or a future, live the moment, forget the moment, and I keep in that particular phase, you know. And then I keep believing where these thoughts arise from, you know, the origin of thoughts. And is there a way, can we be more aware about the thoughts, which I try to do, and just try to distance myself, become more aware about the thoughts. And so the, otherwise the thoughts would lead me to an action, which will probably not my conscious action.
True, very true. That is a sadhana in many schools. But that requires a lot of time and focus. You can't keep doing that if you're a working man, for example. But if you're sitting in an ashram, then you can have a sadhana for that. But the beauty of this teaching is that automatically you are no longer involved in the thoughts which arise in the duration of time. Earlier, we were involved in the thoughts and lost in it. You know, because a thought comes and then we get entangled in it. And then that is the start of the cause-effect loop. If I have a issue with someone, I'm just waiting for them to say something and I'll pounce, right? Because I'm stuck in this loop. Now, when the concept of non-doership is understood in the heart, when I know the person is not the doer, the thought may still arise. I have no control over the thought. But the involvement in the duration of time which causes suffering is no longer there.
So that's the supreme understanding, you know, not to be entangled with the thoughts. Now there is a section of more, I would say, Western kind of thoughts, not the Eastern Indian kind of thoughts, which try to tell you to change the pattern of your thoughts, be more positive, think positive, you know, be kind, you know. They try to make there's an effort right there, you know, just to change the whole entire process, you know. You know, that really not resonates with me when it comes to the what I try to understand, think, listen of the non-duality, you know. Is that an option, changing the quality of the thought?
If it appeals to you. Now, it is true that we are actually conditioned to be life negative. We always fear lack. We fear being poor. These are negative thoughts, right? So the science of affirmation says that because you are life negative, why not think positive? So there's nothing wrong with the science. It is shifting the polarity from negative to positive. This is even in our scriptures. Rewiring the brain, it is there. But unfortunately, what has happened is the science of affirmations has got pegged onto the material plane. Now, for example, even Advaita is rewiring. If a guru of Advaita says, you are the source, you're shocked. No, I'm this individual. Rewiring, it is the same. Now I'm saying, I'm affirming you are the source. When Nisargadatta Maharaj went to Siddharameshwar Maharaj and Siddharameshwar Maharaj told him, you are that. It had such a deep impact on him that he didn't question it. You are that is the highest affirmation. You are not this is the negation. So nothing wrong with the science, but the way it has been implemented and understood. This teaching is fresh conditioning.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
This teaching is also an affirmation. An affirmation of what? You are not the doer you thought yourself to be. You are that which is operating through everyone. And when this becomes your living experience, when you step out, you meet people, your friends, your colleagues at work, the stranger on the road, it really starts changing your whole perspective about people. And things like praise and criticism are of equal measure now. Earlier, you loved to be praised. The ego loved to be praised. Why? Because I did it and now I'm being praised. Now, while pleasure may arise, but when there's criticism, so be it. That is why they say you become less...
like zombie.
You become, you don't get so taken up by pleasure, you don't get taken up by condemnation. अरे इसने मुझे ऐसे बोला, ही टोल्ड यू दिस अबाउट मी, हाउ डे ही, यू नो हाउ वी आर मायर्ड इन ऑल दैट.
सो ग्रेजुअली लेस पुश्ड एंड पुल्ड.
यस यस
इट इज अ ग्रेजुअल.
या इट इज बेटर इफ इट इज ग्रेजुअल.
Yeah.
If it is sudden,
it will reappear.
It could. And then you could go to a hospital. Gradual is always best.
Yeah.
Slow and steady does win the race.
Yeah, sure.
Slow and steady. There's no rush. We can do it for lifetimes upon lifetimes upon lifetimes. What does it matter? But it began. That is what we have to be grateful for. Imagine living a life of unawareness. What a gift it is to be even be drawn to such a subject. It is a tremendous gift. Someone may say something which hurts me. I am a human being, I will be hurt. Then I have to look at my hurt. What was it about? Or I may feel like I must express myself to this person. You know, you said something which hurt me. But because I'm no longer focused on he hurt me, now how do I hurt him back? Now things have changed. That obsession is gone.
Mm.
Now I'm more objective. But the joke is, when I really realize nobody really hurt me and it was my destiny to be hurt, then I don't want to do anything more. The need to also ask or say anything, even that drops away. There's no inner process.
If I'm hurt, checking within, I was meant to get hurt.
No, it would be nice to see what.
What is there?
Yeah, of course.
Make me feel hurt.
Yes, why not? But it need not be necessary. If someone hurts me and I forget about it tomorrow, and the same person says, "Let's go for coffee," I might go without it's the fine. Processing.
That one process is done.
Yeah.
This is the process. Yes. For myself.
Because I am revealing myself. Yes. And invariably I'll find what I thought someone said to me as an individual. Then I say, my God, God made me the way I am, shaped my conditioning. That is why I got hurt. So who got hurt? Hurt was meant to happen in this body-mind organism, which was designed a certain way. Someone else may not have been hurt by the same thing. People are different. But in my case, I got hurt because of the way I'm designed.
So
you see how impersonal it all becomes.
So perceiving it this way, even drops that power of hurt.
Totally.
So it is not reinforced again, is it?
Yeah, because the ego loves to be hurt because now it knows this is me. I am the one who's hurt.
No,
yeah. What is your name?
Milan.
You've come before. First time.
I've come with
Anisha. So it's really such a revealing. It's very beautiful. All the games are laid bare. Isn't it?
Nothing as intoxicating as this.
Yeah.
When it reveals up.
Yeah. I call it the drug of peace of mind in daily living. Nothing is as great as that.
Exactly.
No other drug can compare to that.
I would like to ask something.
Your name?
My name is Nawal.
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 Nawal. What does it mean?
It means a gift of Allah. Yeah, it's a Pakistani name which my grandmother kept for me.
So you are Hindu?
A Muslim. My name is Nawal Khan.
Oh, a beautiful name. It's quite unique, no? Nawal.
I didn't like when I was small.
We normally don't.
I felt it was weird, but now I like it. Yeah, I'm from Mumbai. Actually, I wanted to ask a question, but I'll share a little bit about myself. I've been listening to you from past 5 years, I think more than that. On YouTube, I came across. From childhood, I had this spiritual quest of learning about the bigger questions of life. And of course, when I was small, I started, like my entire family, we used to do namaz and read Quran. So when I grew up, I started reading translation of Quran and I felt, oh yeah, it has some meaning. And when I was in college, I came across Bhagavad Gita, when my teacher used to teach me in Indian ethos class. So I really got attracted to the concept or every, like the translation part. So and so forth. I've been reading other religions also. And I had my own piece of suffering, difficulty with relationship. I got married in 2015, got divorced. It was a difficult phase of my life. But I turned to philosophy. I did my master's while I was going through the divorce and everything. So I did my master's in philosophy. And somehow I came across Advait. I came across your teaching and started reading and listening to that also. And since past 1 year, two, three times I have come here and I've joined on the Zoom class as well. It's been an amazing journey for me. I had been in a lot of pain and difficulty with my relationship, and I had not tasted the peace for a very long time in life, I feel. But I was a peaceful person. I dealt with that in a better way, in forgiveness and letting go and not holding on to it. And that's how I'm living now. Recently, so I always believed in love. I had a childhood love marriage, like, you know, I met my ex-husband when we were in school and all of that. So recently, one of my friends, she asked me that, you know, are you still looking for love and what is going on? So I told her that, I just reverted her that I am love, so I'm not looking for it.
My God. Wow. You have a Sufi in our midst.
Yeah.
Advaitic hyperism.
Beautiful. And then? Did she laugh at you or was she shocked? Or?
I don't know. I was shocked that I replied her like that. But I was happy. Well, however, I wanted to ask you one thing that when you said that, you know, what he shared, that it's a gift. It's a gift that we are at least in this process, we are aware. So what I feel nowadays is that I enjoy my peace. I love it. Being in awareness and meditating and, you know, checking on myself, how I'm feeling and not getting too much in doership. But at the same time, like last week, it so happened that something happened in the house and, you know, I got a little affected and it disturbed me. And then suddenly I could feel the emotional burden on my body, how much it was hurting. It, like, you know, the tightness, the pain, the hollowness, all of that. And suddenly when I felt it, like, I think I felt it after months. And I was happy and I didn't feel that for a long time. But when I felt that this week, I felt disturbed. I was like, oh, this feeling is not good. I don't want to be in this feeling. So of course, the first thing I did was I decided that I'll go back from work. I will go home. I will meditate. It will help me. So I meditated. I also do yoga in evening. So I did my yoga and of course, like it's been 4 or 5 days now to what happened that day. But then I thought that, is it like I'm thinking too much and I do too much meditation that now I find it very difficult to even bear this? You know, is my tolerance less with my own emotional discomfort? I mean, if you could say something on this.
No, in fact, it's the opposite. And this is a very important point. Because there are people who are lost in the emotional body. They are not aware they are psychologically suffering, and all these, the tightness, the aches, the pains, the headaches are symptoms of that. There's been no awakening to any spiritual journey of sorts. Now here's a case where someone has tasted that and has been in that for a while and has now realized that when that discomfort is there, even that slight discomfort is so much. That is why, in fact, even Joel Goldsmith would say that for those on the spiritual path, the smaller indiscretions affect them more.
Sensitivity.
You see?
The sensitivity, yeah.
So I would look at it as a gift because it adds to your knowing. Now you know what that feels like because you were not feeling like that for a while. Yeah. Now you know it. That when I am lost in this, this is what happens, this is how I feel. Everything on the spiritual journey is adding to your awareness. Now, the stress is if I'm trying to be the perfect human being. Because I've tasted the peace and because I think I am love, that means I should not get caught up in an event or in what someone says. But we are not perfect. When we understand that our conditioning has been given by God, the next moment has been given by God. I may falter, so what? That is life and living. So I stop judging myself for having fallen off the pedestal. That is where my suffering is. I allow it. I say, okay, even this happened. I thought it wouldn't, considering the last 6 months I was so happy, but it did. Yeah. What can I do with it now?
As in the thought that I'm reading, so I keep reading a lot and keep like staying in peace, and I'm a teacher, so there also I can maintain my composure. So I think, yeah, exactly, like I started feeling that the others are not exposed to the reading or spiritual path, but I am. So how did I, do this? I shouldn't have done.
So that's where the doer has stepped in.
Yeah.
Because I still think I'm the doer.
That guilt, that I should be at peace and I shouldn't have done.
So who is the one saying that? That is the troublemaker. It is like I have written about this, I don't know in which book, that someone told me she had been a follower of Eckhart Tolle's teachings, The Power of Now was a Bible. And she said for 6-7 years, I was in the now. And then she had a fight with a boyfriend. And when she got out of the car, she slammed the door shut. She said, how could I do that? She was shocked and she was disturbed and she went into a mental turmoil. And I said, look, yeah, you're a human being. Power of now doesn't say you have to be that all the time. But you have taken ownership of this incident. I did it. I should not have done it considering I've been okay for 5 years. This is the doer stepping in. In the sage, he may bang the door shut, but the sage will not hesitate to tender an apology should the need arise or if he feels like doing it. He will not hold on to that. We hold on to it. You know, but do you still say I am love? I'm curious just to know that. You know, the artist Salvador Dali, are you familiar with art? So he was in the category of surrealist painters. Surrealist painters their paintings were reflective of the dream state. So a lot of things wouldn't make sense in the paintings. Like, you know, how to even explain it? There was a painting which I think was called A Little Girl Lifting the Skin of the Sea to See a Dog Lying Beneath It. So you'll find the painting that there's a dog sleeping on the seabed and there's the skin of the water and a girl is lifting. Surrealism was this in a simplified form. So his paintings were very psychedelic and crazy. So someone asked him, someone from the press asked him, sir, do you do drugs? So he replied, I don't do drugs, I am drugs. Yeah, you were saying something more.
Yeah, I last week when I had come, I had taken End of Separation and I read that. And of course, like, it was amazing. Very beautiful. I also had one more question in my mind, actually. In the week, I was thinking about it. I thought, when I'll come here, I will ask you that when we are making a decision or we are supposed to do something, there's this something that I've heard from childhood, that there's a voice of gut or a voice of your heart. And second is the voice of your ego, or maybe, you know, there are two voices within you. Okay, you should do this, you should not do this. How do we identify what is the correct voice, or is all the voices the ego? Or
so I don't subscribe to this theory too much, that you must listen to your heart and not this and your mind and all, because, you know, we are in daily living. We have to deal with situations. Let's say I need a job, right? My heart may not want the job which I got, but I need it, right? I don't have the luxury of listening to my heart in this situation unless I am willing to bear the consequences. So I get a job. Let's say they say, we are paying you 50,000 rupees a month. I know my heart is not in it, but I know right now it's difficult to get another job, so I should stay with it. So that is my mind rationalizing and taking a decision. What is wrong with that? So I would not get too lost in this mind and heart kind of thing. The difference between the mind and heart is important when it comes to the teaching. So let's say this teaching appeals to me. It makes sense that nobody is the doer of their actions, right? It makes sense. So I see the shaitan in front of me and realize they are designed that way, correct? That is the mind. But I may still find I'm reacting like I was based on my past conditioning. That means the teaching has not sunk into the heart. When that transition happens, then I know the difference between the heart and the mind. Do you get what I'm saying? Tomorrow, someone says something and with spontaneous realization, they are not the doers of their actions. I don't have to go through the mental process. Then that is the teaching in the heart. But till that time, because this is new conditioning, I have to
process it.
Situations happen, things people say. That is so. In that sense, there's the only difference between the mind and the heart is the level of awareness. It's not the mind and this heart. It's not that. It's the level of awareness. And so, you know, the recalibration, the vibration which is being recalibrated for you as you live your life in daily living, by and by is coming to a certain equilibrium, which one could call the heart. The heart of awareness. Listen.
You also call it, sir. Call it knowing and being.
Yeah.
You could call it that. Well said. Now, the thing is, if I fall in love, do I listen to my mind or listen to my heart? And someone who has fallen in love and unfortunately it has not worked out will start questioning the heart, isn't it? And then the mind will step in and say, hey, next time I better be careful about falling in love, because it does not guarantee the outcome. We cannot discount the mind, you see. We have been given the mind for a purpose. Yet we cannot live only by the mind. Now, in the traditional guru-disciple relationship, it is a very important point. Because that is a relationship unlike any other. It is a relationship of total surrender. If that has not happened, the mind is still operating. I'm still looking at the guru as an individual, analyzing what he or she is saying, comparing, judging. That is also part of the process. But those who have been able to surrender to, whether it is Ramana Maharshi, Ram, Krishna, whoever, complete surrender, they did not doubt. As Maharaj would say, Nisargadatta Maharaj, you don't doubt the teacher because they have your best interests at heart. So in that case, some disciples who don't have the aptitude for using the mind too much just offer a full surrender that whatever the master is saying is right. That is why I cite this example of the Sufi mystic Bhai Sahib Radha Mohan, where he tells his disciple Irina Tweedy that if I say this is a black chair, it is a black chair. And she says, no, it is a brown chair. But he said, I'm saying it is a black chair. And she argues, no. Then she says, all right, you are the guru. If you say it's black, it's black. He says, no. If I say it is black, you have to see it as black. What is he pointing to? You are seeing things as a certain appearance and you are lost in that. You think you know best. You think what you are seeing is right. I am offering a different dimension and you are resisting it. You are resisting it. You are so stuck on your view, which proves that surrender has not happened.
It's not about rationalism.
Yes.
The true meaning of Islam is surrender.
Yes.
Literal translation.
Yes.
So,
sorry. What do you teach?
I teach human behavior.
Human behavior? Then I should be coming to you for satsang.
I teach in management school and then I have done my MA in philosophy. So
I'm sure this teaching would be of tremendous benefit to you to take it forward, you know. It really clears out so much clutter. That's beautiful.
I'm grateful that I have met you also in this journey and then reading and knowing about so many people, so many gurus and their teachings. That really helps. And it has personally helped me in my life as well.
That is the main thing, because then when we speak or impart it to others, it's from experience. So it's a job which you're happy with.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
Actually, I'm a principal of that college.
Oh my God.
Slowly. An hour from the conversation will be somewhere.
Maybe she owns the college.
She'll have a parallel chair there.
No, I'm just a little hesitant to share that, but that gives me an opportunity to meet a lot of parents, students, to connect with them. So what you say that, you know, what we are learning, that has to come in our daily living.
Yeah, and you are in a situation where it's all about relationships.
Yes.
This is the ground for the teaching to bloom and flourish.
And one of the passage where, you know, where you were talking about in end of separation only, where I read, where you said that when you were working even like personally what I've read about you, you are a person who believes in handling, being a leader, who is a calm leader. People believe that leadership means that you should yell at everyone. You should bring authority on table, command. But when I operate as a leader, I also believe that, yes, you know, I should respect everyone. At the same time, firmly put what I want to put to others, get the work done, respect them, honor them. And I try to bring that in my daily living. And the same thing I try to take to the classroom and share with students. And I want to, I mean, I It comes, these practices are something, this reading is something which, if it is not coming in my daily living, then what?
That's beautiful. I mean, I think that's the best way to lead, but I might be wrong, I don't know. I truly feel that's the best way.
I feel peaceful. People around me, they also find meaning in what they are doing, so I'm glad.
That is very beautiful if they do find that meaning. You see, because one thing was clear to me. At work, work is the field of Rinanubandhan. It's not about student, teacher, colleagues. It appears like that. There is a cosmic give and take which brings two people together. Relationships. What is the exchange going on between these two relationships? And people follow by example, not by what you tell them.
Yes.
They see you for who you are, and the way you interact with others, that is what they imbibe. Because the rest is theory. That is why the famous saying, be a light unto yourself. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Is it your first time too?
No, I have attended your talk at
You're her friend.
2 months back, yeah. So,
mine is a very basic question. I'm struggling with a situation in life where one family member is constantly filing cases on us also and others also, outsiders also. Now, we are trying to follow satsang and santmat and forgive him. But after forgiving, then again there is a court case that we have to attend to. We have to shell out fees to the lawyers.
What is your forgiveness to do with the court case?
No, matlab, I forgive him for filing a court case on me.
Right.
But then it becomes very difficult to keep forgiving him every time. And my family life is going for a toss because of all this. So then santmat, to follow santmat and to face real life also. I want to understand what is the lesson that Divine is trying to teach me, which I'm still not able to learn.
It's quite simple. And these are very different things. You have been placed in a situation in which you are at the receiving end in terms of court cases. You didn't ask for them. They came. They came unasked. Means they are meant to happen. Did you have a choice in that? This is the first step to recognize what comes unasked, pleasure or pain, is what is meant for you. Now, why satsang? Because in challenges in life, whether it is monetary, health, love, these are the three biggest ones, can I find my peace? At the material level, I'm being sued, I'm being taken to courts and so on. That is bound to cause suffering. But when I accept, no matter how hard it is, this truly is the divine will, else it would not have happened. It is happening and it is happening repeatedly. But it is happening. So where do I find my peace? It does not mean I have to love this person for being an instrument of God. I have to accept that they are playing out their script. They are playing out their blueprint the way God designed it. That is all. Where is the question of forgiving and not forgiving? If you are familiar with the teachings of Shirdi Sai Baba, there are so many accounts of Rinanubandhan, which he would call cosmic debts being repaid in certain lifetimes. If we go down that story, it is very believable. We don't know because our vision is limited. Now, with satsang, which is nothing but the company of truth, and what is the truth? Nothing is apart from God, although it may appear to be. When I start living in that truth, I still have to suffer, I still have to go to court if I'm being dragged to court, I will do it. But now I know there's a divine will operating, which is playing this game out. Then I will do what I have to do. If I have to file a counter case, if I have to do whatever, X, Y, Z, I have to do it. Where's the choice? That part will be my suffering. But the additional suffering, how dare he do this to me? I will never forgive him. This is what the truth takes away. This immersion, which is already I'm imprisoned in a circumstance. Now I'm adding to that imprisonment and converting simple imprisonment into rigorous imprisonment. My hate and blame and condemnation is of no value. It is affecting my peace. What can you do? Tomorrow, God forbid, God comes to you and say, either you have this troublemaker in your life or I will send you another problem in your health. Which would you choose?
What I've got used to.
Well said. Well said.
I've learned how to...
Well said.
Yeah.
So you see, when we say, what is the use of sangat, satsang, what are you talking about? The only use is satsang. You are still looking at individuals as individuals and want certain outcomes which you're not getting. So you're questioning satsang. It is the other way around. You have to question yourself.
So the lesson that I need to learn from this situation that God has put me in is?
You have to face what comes unasked with equanimity and calm, preferably knowing. Nobody is the doer of their actions. Everyone is playing out their script. In your life, whether it is your family, friends, colleagues at work, each has come with a certain blueprint in which you are part of it. It's a give and take. We don't know who's giving and who's taking and when the roles will be reversed. We don't know. So we have to play our role to the best of our ability. That's all we can do.
Without taking things personally.
In that sense, nobody is the doer of their actions. Which basically means I accept, no matter how bizarre it looks, that how could a person be this way? I can't figure it out with my rational mind. But I accept that they are the way they are, the way God has made them. What do I know what happened to him in his childhood? I have no idea how he was treated as a baby. I don't know. You see, people, all this formative conditioning makes people who they are. And then they bring it out on others, so to speak, as they grow up. We don't know. What is the point of judging people? I just have to try my best to either convince the person that it's a waste of time what they are doing, or to go to court, hire the best lawyers I can afford, and just continue doing my bit. That is all. And what saves one is satsang.
Yeah. True.
It is like a man is drowning and the hand of God reaches out to save him and he says, what use is this hand? I'm drowning. That is what you are saying.
I feel bad that I'm listening to satsang and I'm not able to forgive and I keep getting back into that cycle. So I was wondering that what should I do?
If you are drawn to listening, continue listening.
Okay. Okay. I am drawn to listening.
And all the best with the court cases. No, really, it can be a big drain on energy. Big drain on energy.
You can see everything washing down. Thank you. I have a question in this matter. So if I forgive someone, does it fall into doership?
Yes.
It does.
But it's the first step.
Yeah.
The first step is forgiveness. Knowing that they are not the doers of their actions, you would not even bother forgiving.
Yeah, exactly. The first step is not seeing them as doers. So that is the first step. So this matter will not arise of forgiving. Right? One more, can I? Yeah. When you were talking about the disciple and guru matter, the disciple not having any doubt on guru, right? Total surrender, which means no doubt. So does this apply to everything that happens and everyone? Does it?
No, not at all. It cannot, it may not apply to another guru disciple.
I'm not talking about guru. I'm talking about a real life situation.
No, certainly not. No.
Means that doubt factor should not be there. That is what I'm talking about.
Can you give me an instance?
Means anything happens in my real, actual life, some situation or some person. So that doubt factor should not come. But if this is taken care of, no doership from the other side, even I'm, so then that doesn't arise, right?
That does not arise, but I still have to do what I think and feel I should do. I have to use my rational mind, my working mind, and figure out the situation. Surrender in this case does not mean I become a vegetable or I'm non-responsive. It does not mean that.
When I came here, just an event, like some phone call came. I picked the phone, it said, in 2 hours, all your communication lines will be cut. Press 9 to...
Some scan.
Yeah. We have to doubt such things, obviously.
Yeah, if you surrender to it. Very good example. Very good example.
What do you mean by the source? Like, I mean, I'm not familiar with...
You can call it God, you can call it consciousness, you can call it source. In what, can you explain what the doubt is?
I mean, I would understand it maybe from a like psychology perspective, like of being conscious, of being aware of...
That's good.
Okay.
That's actually even better. Basically, what we mean is that the manifest world as we see it, we see forms and appearances. The manifest world is just an appearance arising in consciousness. You're familiar with consciousness. If you were not conscious, the manifest world would not arise. So what is the source? Consciousness. Now, this consciousness, so it is easily accepted by the masses, is referred to as God. And that God is given a form, because we are in the world of form, so we relate to form. So that is when God comes in. How else does it come in? When I realize that my precious will, which I'm exercising in daily living, is not leading to the desired outcome, we call it God's will. Why do we call it God's will? Because it is not my will, is not giving me the outcome I thought I wanted. There's another power, another force. So the concept of God's will is brought in, to show that there is a higher will, so to speak, than the puny will of the little me, which is trying to control its life. That is God, consciousness, call it what you want. It is a concept to expose the ego, which is identified with the name and form, that you are not this limitation. So as to end on Goldsmith's note, see, God in the midst of all means you're not to visualize, let's say, a particular God in the middle of them. To see this one awareness, consciousness, field, which is operating through the entire manifest world, bringing about what is meant to be brought about. That is the divine vision. That is the vision of the third eye, not the eyes of duality. That is called seeing God in everyone. Because if I take away your personality and his personality, what is still left is awareness, consciousness, devoid of personality. When you were a baby, when he was a baby, pure consciousness functioning without the load of conditioning. Awareness consciousness, which is always at play. So when we start seeing this unicity behind multiplicity, we are resting in God, in consciousness, in awareness. It is awareness. All right. Next time we can take it further.